Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The end of a marriage through divorce is nearly always stressful and sad for those involved. And while the reasons for a relationship's collapse are often intensely personal, the traditional method of dividing up assets and responsibilities forces a sometimes intrusive legal system into the process and often gives exes a host of new things to fight about. But there is an alternative. A practice gaining traction with family law attorneys is as a way to minimize conflict at the end of the marriage and also to avoid the specter of having personal matters aired and decided in court. It's called collaborative law, and joining us to talk about how and why it works are two attorneys who have seen how well it works. Camille Milner practices family law out of her own firm in Denton. Kevin Fuller is a partner at Coons, Fuller, Vanden Eichel, and Robertson in Dallas. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
So we'll start with this. Stuart Webb, who is the guy who sort of pioneered this, essentially argues that the traditional divorce process can actually make things worse for couples. How does that happen?
Well, I think it makes things worse in that when a divorce starts, there's already obviously conflict. The marriage is breaking up for a reason. When you go to court, there's very little about going to court that reduces the level of conflict. Unfortunately, if you're in trial or you're in a hearing, the mode sort of is attack the other person and be attacked by the other person. And so it tends to increase conflict dramatically and cause even more problems for a family already in conflict.
Well, and there's also this idea that your attorney is there to represent you, and therefore, in people's minds at least, and maybe historically, people assume that the other attorney, their ex-partner's attorney, is just out to get them for everything they can get.
Unfortunately, the end game when you go through litigation is going to be that somebody wins and somebody loses. There's no real reconciliation that's not part of the goal. That, unfortunately, is just the system that we have been working under for a long time in this field. But it was never really a good fit for families and family law. So when this came to Texas in the 80s or early 90s, we were all very refreshed to see that, and what we like to say is rather than just being an alternative, that it's now a new option.
You know, the term collaborative, I guess in Texas we call it collaborative law, when you're applying this to divorce, it sounds like an oxymoron. How does it happen that two people who have likely been at odds for some time can even agree that this is a good way to go about this?
I think it's collaborative means trying to work together to solve a problem. And the structure of the process and the theme behind the process is to have the lawyers and the parties as much as possible work as problem solvers. And even though there's conflict, even though there's adversarialness, again, the goal and the structure of the process is to solve problems, not assess blame for the problems. It's like a couple standing outside of their house watching it burn down, and instead of arguing over whose fault the fire is, they try to put out the fire. You know, that's the collaborative process, is problem solving.
And how much of this is the work of attorneys, and how much is the work of other people that might be part of the team that takes a couple through this?
Well, originally, when the process came to Texas, we were all trained in interest-based negotiation, which, just for point of comparison, what historically it's been is position-based, as Kevin said, one side against the other. When you're working with interest-based, what you're trying to focus on and explore with the clients is what do they have in common as far as interests. Now, when it was just the lawyers and the clients initially, which was the original Texas model, that worked all right. But eventually we learned that if we brought in a mental health professional who is serving as the communications coach and a neutral third party, and then a financial planner to assist the clients and the lawyers in developing what their common interests are and exploring all those options, that it was a much better product. And at least in Denton County, where I practice, our practice group has made a philosophical commitment to only doing the team approach. And I think that while it's not all around Texas yet, I think that's certainly the move that is now taking place.
You mentioned a financial planner. I know that one of the things that's critical to this process is full disclosure of things. And there are some very, very harsh recriminations for people who might deliberately hide assets or hide liabilities. Can you talk about that?
In the collaborative law participation agreement that the attorneys and the parties sign when we agree to do a case collaboratively, one of the clauses in there is that if it turns out that property has been intentionally and fraudulently not disclosed by a party, that property is awarded 100% to the other party. So it's a big dose of put your money where your mouth is.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of couples would seek this out? Is it already people who are amicably divorcing?
Not necessarily. There are some limits that some people feel that this realm should probably not go into, and that is if there's extreme mental issues or if there's extreme drug abuse or domestic violence. Surprisingly, though, even in those areas, with the communications coach and the proper mental health professionals on board, that still seems to be a better way in most cases. And the reason is, again, because if these parties who have these additional issues go to court, they're going to feel even more disenfranchised, that they have less control over their world. And in many of those cases, that makes them have even more extreme mood swings than they might otherwise. So our favorite trainer out of California, Chip Rose, I asked him that question once, which cases don't qualify? And he said, every case qualifies. It's just a matter of the skill level of the professionals. So that's sort of my default. Now, truly, there are some that with time we are all learning might not be as good a candidates, but we don't, at least the people that are heavily involved and committed to collaborative law, I think that is our default now. And then we see the ones that won't be a good fit for that, then maybe they have no choice but to go to litigation.
With high conflict families that are having a lot of conflict, many times they end up in the courtroom. Many times they end up in aggressive litigation against each other. Most of the mental health professionals that work with children in particular all tell us that high conflict is not good for children. And so some of these high conflict cases, the families and the children are better off in the collaborative process if they can stay there. It's very difficult. It doesn't mean everything is nice and wonderful. All the conflict is still there, but it's contained inside this process and without going to court. Many times, you know, when you go to court with these high conflict families, the children, the parents suffer even worse in the litigation process.
So at the heart of collaborative law is this agreement by both attorneys involved that if the case cannot be settled through this process and if it has to go to court, both attorneys will resign from the case and the couple will have to start over from scratch. That's part of the advantage and for many people part of the controversy with this.
Initially it was. Many people would come in with serious concerns about that being what happened in their particular case. But when you look at the level of skill that is being brought to this round table, if you will, of collaborative law, it is a very, very small number that, as we say, break out of it and have to go back to litigation. Because what you have with this is from the very get-go, instead of one party filing a suit and the other party teeing up to fight, you are beginning the healing process and the structure for the healing process for this family so that they become a restructured, albeit not married family. They are still a family in most cases. And with the proper support with these other professionals, we are fixing, if you will, their restructured family, whether it's finances or children's issues or the emotional issues between the parties. And so in that way, we feel like it is by far the better way.
I was reading last night over this sort of sample document that a couple might sign at the outset of a process like this, and it seems like it stops them from doing a lot of really nasty things to each other that might not have occurred to them until they got into the process of things, like cutting off each other's insurance or making, you know, causing damage to property and things like that. Thankfully, I've not experienced this. I guess people really go through some pretty crazy ideas about ways to get back at each other if you don't stop them from doing that at the beginning.
Well, absolutely. in Dallas County, anyway, there's a standing restraining order that is issued immediately when any divorce is filed, and it prohibits people from cutting off insurance, cutting off credit cards, running away with all the money, destroying
electricity,
people's personal belongings. And that's just that's part of the going in order in the litigation process. And in the collaborative law process, we have those same mutual agreements and mutual orders that are part of that process as well.
How does this work for people with children? It sounds like this, a lot of these cases involve families with children. It's typical for couples to have to go back 5 years later and sort of renegotiate the way custody will work or payments. Is collaborative law still different at that point?
In modification situations?
Yeah.
I get the hope is if they do their divorce in the collaborative process, as part of that, they will learn an effective way to communicate with each other and to negotiate with each other when they reach disagreements. And again, in a modification situation, if they're in high conflict and big disagreement, using that model, using the neutral mental health professional to come in and work with the parties about their options and their problems is a more family-friendly way to attempt to solve that problem than sometimes the litigation model is.
And in the decrees now, we are in the collaborative agreements and in the decrees, we're adding that extra layer of professional that rather than, as I said earlier, teeing up to go back to court, their first stop then is back either to the collaborative process and or meeting with the communications coach or the child specialist so that if problems do arise, and we have seen this happen not as often as cases that usually have been litigated, but when there is a bump in the road, then they default back to talking to one of the people that are best equipped to help them iron that out.
So again, the primary goal is to keep the whole thing out of court, even when you have to go back and revisit an issue.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. What sort of outcomes have you seen in terms of the way people deal with each other on an ongoing basis? Again, people with no kids can often just walk away, and people who have families to raise together have to communicate for however many years.
Well, in general, I mean, that's the whole point of it, is that in a successful or moderately successful collaborative law case, that after that process is over, that people feel good enough about each other that they can co-parent together if they have children, or if they have property together, you know, maybe they don't have children, but they still have property issues that they need to unwind as part of the settlement, they can function together better than they can in litigation. If a case has gone to trial, the parties are not going to get through that trial without being attacked and attacking the other. And it just makes family get-togethers, graduations, all that sort of thing more difficult. You know, eventually those families may come around and heal and get past those wounds, but indefinitely it will take them longer in the litigation mode.
Kevin Fuller and Camille Milner are here. We're talking about the benefits of collaborative law in divorce. You can join our conversation right now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. After the break, we will take your calls, and we'll also talk about the economic benefits to divorcing couples of collaborative law.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the benefits of using collaborative law to divorce with Camille Milner, who's an attorney, and also Kevin Fuller, an attorney. You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Camille, what happens when people don't use this process and one person feels that they have either won or lost big in the divorce?
Or even if it's a settlement that one side is disgruntled, and rarely do you have settlements where both sides get everything they want. In fact, I don't think you could find a lawyer that's ever had one. So there may be some bitterness. There's a fellow out in California, in San Diego, named Bill Eddy, who is a lawyer and a social worker, and he's done a great deal of studying on this, authored a book, and is now doing some institutes to help us as professionals understand that frequently when clients go to court or have a settlement that they are not completely satisfied with, that they get on high center or they can't move on. And whether that is as a parent, what it may result in is that they badmouth the other parent to the children, which damages the children, of course, or they may carry this on into other relationships because of the bitterness. Well, in collaborative cases, with the communications coach there to help us on those issues and help us on the hopefully healing of these parties, in most cases, they end as friends. And they're not going to either one again be perfectly satisfied with every aspect of the settlement, because it is hard work. These are life issues, and it's not going to be sitting around a table holding hands and singing Kumbaya. That's what some perception of it might be, and it's not that at all. It's still very, very hard work. But as I said earlier, the end game is resolution and a reconciliation, whereas not being together reconciled, some level of peace.
So you've talked about a team of professionals that works together. You've talked about couples meeting multiple times to work through this. It doesn't sound like it would be less expensive than a traditional kind of divorce. How does that happen?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. One of the most shocking internal statistics that I have is I have, over the last 2 years, I handled what I would call two very heavily litigated cases, which is not the norm, okay? But the expenses from those two heavily litigated cases exceeded the attorney's fees for the 43 completed collaborative law cases that I've handled.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. That's you know, those two cases were again, heavily litigated, not the norm. The norm is a case, even in the litigation model, is going to settle. And the fees from settling a case in the litigation model and the fees from settling in the collaborative model may oftentimes be similar, or they may be in the collaborative model lower. Certainly the fees that you spend in the collaborative model are more efficiently spent in this sense. Every dollar you spend on your attorneys or the financial professional, the mental health professional, is spent trying to settle, trying to work through the problem, trying to work through the issues. When you spend money in the litigation process, you may be spending money on things that have nothing to do with settling, you know, dealing with procedural things and discovery and things like that.
And how does it work in smaller counties like in Denton?
What we have seen in Denton is it's been a mixed blessing in a way. Denton on the northwest side is still fairly rural. That's changing rapidly, but in the last 10 years, it's still been sort of a microcosm of both metropolitan and smaller areas, which has been a blessing in that we have been forced to develop collaborative law with a little bit different goal in mind and making it very, very available to middle and lower income people. Now, how we've done that are using a lot of creativity, such things as enabling, instead of it being a joint meeting, have the clients go off with the financial professional or the communications coach and spend a great deal of time with them doing such things as developing inventories and options for division of property or developing the parenting plan, and then us just gathering back for the joint meetings for a couple of times. That hasn't made it necessarily cheaper than the the regularly settled cases that were going to be amicable. But as Kevin said, it seems to be a much better product, or at least a more satisfactory product, not necessarily better, but a more satisfactory product, because clients feel that all the issues have been explored together.
So for the same amount of money, perhaps you end up happier with the result or the way that it was able to be decided.
That's what we believe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jeff in Grapevine. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. My question is there an expectation or realization in the number of these cases where the parties actually end up not separating? And I'll take the answer offline. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Well, we have actually had a number that did reconcile, if that's the question, and I think it is. What we have seen happen is very often parties plan a divorce because they aren't communicating. And when they sit down at the table and begin learning skills that unfortunately they have lost or maybe never had, a whole new world may open up for them. Now, this really isn't the goal that we're seeking, because we have been trained to be lawyers. But we are all very welcoming of that being another hopeful byproduct and outcome, and have had a number of happy clients that found the way to stay together through this process.
I have to tell you, the whole thing sort of humanizes lawyers. And even hearing both of you talk, even in the breaks, about having to work with couples, it's not, of all things, divorce is not one of those cases, I guess, where you can just have people sign the papers and decide what they want. It's a very human, interactive thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's very, very difficult, very, very emotional for the clients. Even in the friendliest of divorces, or most amicable of divorces, there's lots of emotion, lots of things going on. And that's, one of the reasons we have the neutral mental health professional involved in this process, because a lot of times what's going on in a family or what's going on in a divorce is about 90% emotional, and maybe 10% legal financial. And the lawyers, man, we know lots and lots about the law and lots about the finances. But, where I went to law school, they didn't teach me much about how to handle somebody that's sitting in front of you crying. It's just not what we did.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sally in Dallas. Hi, Sally.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, could couples who are not traditional married couples choose to engage in a collaborative divorce process? Perhaps people that are same-sex couples, or people who've not chosen to go through an official ceremony? And if so, would it be a legally binding contract, the decisions made afterward?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
As far as the process, the collaborative process is a problem-solving model, and so really any problem you can try to resolve inside that process with its tools and procedures. So the answer to the first part of that is absolutely, you could use that process for that kind of situation. Now the second question is whatever agreement you ended up with at the end, would it be legally binding? That would depend. I know that's not a great answer, but it would just depend on what that agreement is.
An additional area, or areas that collaborative law is now venturing into in Texas, is in probate, guardianship, and those civil areas. It, again, is a perfect fit for those. And it might be that families that, as one of our probate judges in Denton County says, have been fighting since the sandbox. And while Kevin and I primarily deal in families that are husband and wife and fighting over children, you also have children fighting over parents and guardianships, or children and family members fighting over family estates. So what we are seeing, as Kevin said, is this is a process that's problem solving, and it, we believe, by a grassroots effort, by people wanting this sort of thing more than litigation, that it is absolutely the new world order in the coming world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guests are Camille Milner and Kevin Fuller, both attorneys and experts in collaborative law. Let's go next to Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I had a collaborative divorce in September of 2002, and I'm so glad to hear that now you have a mental health coach and communicative coaches and other people besides just the two attorneys and the two spouses that are trying to divorce, because my ex is an attorney, and he's very demonstrative, and there was some emotional abuse in the marriage, and I think we are still having problems communicating after 5 years of the divorce because he is such a demonstrative person and tries to control everything. So I am so glad to hear that now the process has changed a little bit.
Thanks so much for your call. I know that that's one point that when you're selecting couples or recommending this, you do want them to be sort of evenly matched in a lot of ways. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that's important?
Well, usually they're not evenly matched.
And really?
The most common situation that I see is that either the husband or the wife, one or the other, is going to have a better command of the financial aspects of the divorce, you know, what they own, what the accounts are, how the business runs, et cetera. So there's usually, at a minimum, an imbalance of information. That's a very, very common problem. Secondly, there's often a power imbalance, as the caller was talking about. And one, having your advocate, having your lawyer in the collaborative process helps address that imbalance, both of those imbalances. And then number two, having a neutral mental health person, a communications coach, a neutral financial person, here again, helps address those power imbalances by either intervening when emotions need to be calmed down or confronted or addressed or redirected, or in terms of gathering information for the neutral financial professional involved.
And let me just add, what we train these folks in is that if their goal is to resolve the issues of the marriage and have a divorce decree at the end of the money and time that they've spent in this, then if you've got one party that's overly demonstrative or the one that has the greater power, then they learn very quickly that continuing to assert that power is not going to get the case resolved. And so they understand that by reframing the way they say things or what they're talking about, by getting everybody on a level playing field, then we are able to reach their resolution of their case.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Well, for one thing, I didn't start listening to your show at the very beginning, and so I've gathered that I am a survivor of a collaborative divorce. In fact, it was 5 years ago this week. And I'm glad to hear that you have a mental health professional there to help things along. And I'm just wondering if, I know the person earlier said it would have helped to screen whether or not somebody's more demonstrative than the other. I know at one point the Wall Street Journal had written that it would that certain people are certainly, or certain, if you have somebody who's an alcoholic, if you have somebody who is abusive, as in physically and emotionally abusive, if you have somebody who is a problem that has severe mental health problems, all of these people aren't very good candidates for a collaborative divorce. I'm wondering whether or not they're screened these days, because if I would have gone through a regular divorce, at least my attorney would have been an advocate, as opposed to just sit there and expect my husband and I at the table to say, well, what do you think about this and what do you think about that? Because really by the third meeting, it was just all financial. And if they would have just turned to him and say, you know what? You're perfectly capable of having a job. Go to work and this could be settled. And he kept on saying, well, she's got an income stream and I don't. And so
I think we have your point, because you're talking about.
Well, let me finish. She's not entitled to community property. And so for six sessions, we argued that, whereas if his attorney and my attorney would have said, guess what? It's the law. Get over it. I mean, it would have been a lot easier. So that's all.
Thanks for your call. Let's get
Thank
a response.
You.
Well, as you can tell, first of all, if she went through the collaborative process in 2002, I promise you, everybody that's doing collaborative law, we were all learning.
And it's
we,
evolving it, quickly, it, I guess.
Very, you know, 5 years in the legal profession is nothing. But I think we are getting better at how we do things, and involving the other team members helps. But as you can hear from the caller, these cases are difficult. And sometimes in the collaborative process, what you're looking at is something that is less worse than what that same problem would be in the courthouse. I mean, folks just don't have can't have an appreciation for what it's like to litigate at the courthouse, because you've got two sorts of issues. You know, one, what is the fight about? Is it community property, or is it separate, or is it worth a lot of money or not much? You've got the substantive fight. But on top of that, you have all the procedure and the evidence and the technicality fights that go along with that. And so, you know, sometimes it's not a beautiful thing, but it is a less worse process in many cases. Not all. You know, when you're dealing with bullies, domestic violence, people who are active in substance abuse issues, people who have mental health, mental illnesses, and cannot make decisions, they're not going to be a good candidate for any process. You're going to have problems in collaborative law. You're going to have problems in litigation when you have those kinds of issues.
Kevin Fuller and Camille Milner are my guests. They are both attorneys and experts in collaborative law. We'll return to our discussion after this break. You can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about using collaborative law to divorce with two family law attorneys, Kevin Fuller and Camille Milner. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Jim asks via email, what's the difference between mediation and collaborative law?
Well, I think that we are both mediators and both collaborative lawyers, so we are proponents of both systems. In collaborative law and in the mediation I was trained in, it is interest-based, as we discussed earlier. The difference between collaborative and Texas model mediation is that you have a series of meetings over a period of whether it's weeks or months, depending on the case. And typically in mediations in Texas, you're on a time frame of a day or two. So you're under the gun, if you want to use that term, or at least it's very time pressured to get it finished. And sometimes people make decisions that they might make a little bit differently if they had some time to think about it. And by point of reference, I've had a couple of cases where clients came to an agreement on a particular issue, and then when we had the next collaborative meeting, they wanted to revisit that because one or both of them had thought about some consequences of that particular issue that they wanted to talk about it again. They didn't necessarily change it in substance. They just refined it. Whereas with mediation, if they had signed on the dotted line at the end of that day or the end of the two-day mediation, then they wouldn't have had an opportunity to, with a cool head, think about all the issues a little bit more thoroughly. And again, most people that go through mediation are satisfied with it, but we want them to be as satisfied as is possible, and that's our goal as family lawyers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Kristen in Dallas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I just wanted to let you guys know, I just got divorced, and we used the collaborative process, and it was wonderful, especially in regards to our children. We did the parenting plan, and that was our main goal, was to make it an okay adjustment for the kids. But I did have a question. It was still pretty expensive for us, and I didn't know if you guys were doing anything maybe to help out some families who don't have as much money go through the process as well.
Thanks for your call.
Absolutely. Here in Dallas, we've launched a pro bono collaborative program. And so to help out the poorest of the poor with the collaborative process, if we can, and that's a process that's up and going here in Dallas. And that is the big challenge of the collaborative process, is to make the process more efficient, more affordable for more families. And really, in the process, if you can use the neutrals more to sort through some of these issues, it'll have the effect of lowering the cost. Sometimes if you rely on the or need the lawyers or rely on the lawyers to solve these problems, it's going to be more expensive. And sometimes having the neutrals in there can actually reduce the cost of the process.
Are couples prohibited from contacting each other outside the process and trying to work through things?
No. But what we encourage couples to do is to not try to settle the case necessarily just between the two of them, unless it's going extraordinarily well. You know, I don't know what percentage of the population, when they have a divorce issue, they just work things out at the kitchen table. That is probably the prevailing process. They sit down and work out their problems. And as long as the couple can do that and it's safe and it's healthy and it's productive, then they should do that. But oftentimes, especially in these high conflict cases, what they need is the lawyers at the table, the mental health professional at the table, to contain that conflict and keep it as constructive as possible under the circumstances.
One other cost-saving device, Chris, that has been developed, and I'm not sure if when you introduced Kevin, you said he is the incoming president of the Collaborative Law Institute of Texas. But that's,
I did not. Thank you for noting that.
I wasn't sure if you did, but I did want to say that organization is our professional organization over the state, and they have done an incredible – I have not been a part of the preparation of the forms that they have prepared for all of us that are members of that. And there are so many tools that are now available that even 5 years ago were not available to participants in the collaborative law process, so that much of what originally only the lawyers did, we are now delegating to clients, and that's a big cost-saving device for them. So then we can do what we have the exclusive skills to do in the divorce process and anything else, such as preparing spreadsheets and looking at parenting plans preliminarily, the clients are learning how to do themselves, and that is a cost-saving device for them.
So you basically give them a little homework and say, come back when you have all this information ready.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Elaine in Fort Worth. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I had a quick question for the for your guest today. I was wondering what their experience was with using collaborative law in relocation cases, given the Texas statute.
A relocation case is typically a case where a mom or a dad wants to move out of the city or out of the state with the children as a part of a divorce. And those are, Camille, I think safe to say, some of the most difficult to resolve cases, both at the courthouse and in the collaborative process. I mean, you know, if somebody wants to move to California, you know, you can't split the difference and say, well, okay, how about Nevada or something?
It means one parent will be living much farther away from
the
kids.
Yes, or not. And many times it's accompanied with a job change or a sick family member or a new marriage or something significant. So they're just really hard to resolve. Off the top of I have one case that I can recall clearly where that was the sole issue or the sole significant issue was relocation, and we were able to resolve that in the collaborative process. And, you know, some of what happens is, you know, a lot of times those cases, because they're so hard to get settled, get litigated. And people can spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars resolving the process that maybe could be spent on, you know, airplane tickets, hotel rooms, creative solutions, what have you. So that issue is hard to settle no matter what process you're in.
Chris, if I could just add a little something to that from my perspective. The cases from the appellate courts are divided on that particular question, which means there isn't an absolute rule of thumb. And what results in that, unfortunately, is that gives the judges discretion. And so judges are human, too, and many of them have their own predispositions about relocation issues. And so when we can tell clients, would you rather go into a courtroom with a judge that may have their – whether it's clear or not, they may have an internal bias for or against relocation. And wouldn't they rather, with a mental health provider, plan their children's future and their relationship with them in that private realm with someone that is an expert in that and can give them time to work through it together? And I did recently have a case like that, and we sent them to a parenting coordinator to work through that issue, and they worked through it beautifully, much, much more beautifully and much less expensively than it would have been litigated.
An email from Diane, who's an attorney in Fort Worth, it looks like, asks if you would address what it takes to hire someone who is a competent collaborative law attorney, and how do you choose someone that will represent your family's interests properly, and what the red flags might be?
Well, I think what you have to interview, and certainly one place to start is the Collaborative Law Institute of Texas has a website, collablawtexas.com. That you can go to, and it lists the people that are at least members of the Collaborative Law Institute, lawyers, mental health professionals, and financial professionals. But what you would want to ask is how much training they've had, how many cases they've handled. Just listen to them, and it's like interviewing an attorney for any process. You know, do you have confidence in this person? Do they sound and act like they know what they're doing and instill confidence in you, but interview.
Do you have the sense that most clients do that, or is this a time in their lives when they're upset anyway and they just want someone who can take the case? And do you feel like you're adequately interviewed by your clients?
My clients, yes. I mean, I think more and more people are becoming more sophisticated consumers, legal consumers, and so they do a lot of looking at your websites. They do some research on the process, divorcing in general. And so they come to the interviews with more questions and more things that they want to know, and that's all to the good for them.
And there's a subjective element to it that always was there, but it's also continuing in the collaborative process, and that is people come in looking for what they feel, a personality they feel comfortable with, and that is an element and component of it that they shouldn't leave at the door. In addition to the training and the number of cases that they do, they need to really ask about who the lawyer is, not necessarily personal questions, but their legal philosophies and those sorts of questions. That would be important to the client to feel that they have a philosophical alignment or a comfortable fit with their attorney.
A good collaborative lawyer is going to sound like a problem solver instead of a problem maker. That's a little tip.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Tim in Southlake. Hi, Tim.
Hi. You mentioned about mediation. I'm a non-lawyer mediator. Many times mediation is court-ordered, which forces that time frame in there. But do you see the growth of mediation even earlier in the process, where you're not sitting at the table, but you're not quite ready to go and have the lawyers engaged, showing up more and more in this process?
Well, not necessarily just in this process, but mediation is becoming more prevalent throughout the process of law. One of the things that we are seeing now is what we call early intervention mediation, so that parties go to mediators early in the process before the animosity and anger is heightened, sometimes by the process itself.
How well does collaborative law work in cases where, I'm not talking about one spouse being abusive or deliberately trying to take all the resources, but sometimes there's one person who just wants out. They just want to leave, and then 2 years later might think, can't believe I gave up the house or the car or whatever. Do you, as an attorney, feel required to tell your client maybe you ought to offer her this much more or that much more? Does this make sense?
Are you talking about people who make emotional decisions too hastily? Or
there are some people, I think, who emotionally make decisions to give up more than they would have done otherwise. Does this, you know, they just want to be free of the situation. I wonder how, if collaborative law can work in those situations, or if those cases are always decided in favor of whoever does want the stuff.
Well, absolutely, it can work in the collaborative process. And one of the functions of the neutral mental health professional, the communications consultant, is to address the emotional issues that are going on in the case and in the negotiations. And one of the things would sort of be to help work. They don't do therapy, but work through their thought process about what it is that they're doing. I mean, to me, one of the common things that I see these folks helping the clients with is not letting an emotional reason block a decision that's in their best interest. And by the same time, you don't want somebody making a emotional decision that's not in their long-term best interest. And so the collaborative process, being a process versus an event, gives people time to sort through what they're doing, why are they doing it, is it in their best interest, is it in their interest? Because that's one of the express questions we ask them. What are your goals? What are your interests? What are your concerns? And some people, legitimately, I want out, and I'm willing to pay more to get out quickly. That's okay with me. And if that's truly, truly okay with them, then fine. But you know, if they have buyer's remorse 5 years later, that's where you want to check that emotion before they make the decision.
Does the growth of this process have any impact on the way people look at marriage going into it, prenuptial agreements? Is this sort of filtering down to how people work things out before they become married? Of course, they're getting along at that point. So
we have used it. A number of people, I have used it in premarital agreements. And that is, while it is in the even pre-honeymoon time, it helps people even from that very point realize the significance of being able to communicate well and looking at what their common interests are and looking at what the pitfalls may be if they don't have good communication skills and their common interests. I think people now more and more, because divorce is so common, our impression, contrary to what many people think, is that people don't come in anxious to get divorced. It's a long, thought-out process, and it's something that's sad for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Camille Milner practices family law out of her own firm in Denton. Kevin Fuller is a partner at Coons, Fuller, Van Den Eickel, and Robertson in Dallas. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.